made of the Warren Schlinger oral history tapes, and I'd like to ask Mrs. Schlinger, Katie, can you tell us about yourself?
Well, as well as I can remember, maybe. I was born in Alhambra, California, which is very close to Los Angeles and also Pasadena, and one of two. I have an older sister, 2 years older, and lived most of my life in Alhambra. And my sister, not having very good health, we did move around quite a few places. And my father, who was a graduate electrical engineer from Cornell, had a very serious case of typhoid fever, and so finally had to give up his job with the Edison Company and go into whatever he could find that would be helpful for himself and for my sister. And then, of course, the Depression came along, and he was willing to do anything to support the family. We had a farm at one time with chickens and raised peaches, and my sister and I sat out at the curb and sold peaches and had a great time. Much outdoor life. Well, anyway, that moves on. And then eventually, I had studied, my mother was a concert pianist, and so we studied music with her, and then I was told I had a fairly good singing voice, so I started taking voice lessons and did quite a bit of singing, and then finally became the soprano soloist in our church and did many, many things. We had a Catholic choir director who liked to do the large requiems and wonderful music, had a wonderful music program. And then the war came along, and we decided that school would have to be put off, although I did go to junior college and hoped to go on beyond that. But then the war came along, and I began working at Caltech during the war effort, and as many, many people did, and I had a wonderful job with a nice staff of, probably 20 people at one time, working on war projects, and I had a group of typists and editors, some very interesting people. One was a child's story writer, and one was an editor for what's the company?
McGraw-Hill.
Huh?
McGraw-Hill.
Yeah, McGraw. And I mean, very well-educated people came to work for us because of the war effort. And luckily, I had them in my staff. Well, anyway, then the war was over, luckily, and we went into teaching school. Not I, but I assisted with two professors. Chemical engineering, and we had some graduate students at this point, and I got well acquainted with them and kept their grades and all of that. And then there were two of them that were particularly friendly with me, and one of them asked me to type his master's thesis, which I did for a lot of the boys. And so that's fine. So one evening we spent the evening, and I typed his master's thesis, and as a nice little gift for that, he took me to dinner at a restaurant called Eaton's in Pasadena. And the only reason I mention that is that, well, eventually we seemed to hit it off quite well, and we're eventually married. And our wedding night, I didn't know where we were going to spend our wedding night. After we had a large wedding, and here we came to the same restaurant that he and I had gone to on our very first night, which also had an adjoining motel. So, is that enough?
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. Did you give up working then?
Eventually, yes. Oh, that's right, yes. He was, we debated then whether he should get his doctor's degree and thought he might regret the fact that he didn't. And so we more or less put off, as well as we could, having children, and lived in an apartment, and we both still worked on his doctor's program and doctorate program, and I was secretary to these two, the heads of the chemical engineering department, which I enjoyed anyway, and we had a good time. And then eventually one son came along on his way, and I decided it was time, and he got his doctor's degree in the meantime, so it worked out fine.
Okay. Is all that true?
Yeah.
And I'm still singing.
Better than I can tell.
After this, but now at the moment not singing, but I mean at that time I still did a lot of vocal work, and that's how he came to come here, because I came up as a soloist for Bach Festival and brought my children with a nanny, all three children, and we had a wonderful time. We all fell in love with the area. Finally, I retired from singing, and we just looked at property and found a nice spot.
Very good. What was the year you first sang here? When was that?
The Bach Festival.
Yes.
1956.
And I sang with them for maybe 10 or 12 years. 15.
Well,
you say it's longer than that.
Long time.
And I came when the Schondor was the director, and it was his first year. So it was my first year, and it was fun. And we still enjoy it. We're going to it this week, as every night. Not as participants, but as supporters and audience, which they need also.
Well, you did very well.
Huh?
You did very well.
I did? Well, I sounded a little bit wordy, I'm afraid.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You really can stick around if you want. Anything else you want to do?
Well, I was just sort of picking up the pieces around while I have it.
We have next week. Is that the one?
I'll stop it for a second. So you're doing your master's degree, and you're enjoying it, and you're deciding to stay.
I have a chance to see this beautiful lady every now and then. No, that's true. No, that's right. And but by the time I finish the master's degree, we were involved with something. I don't know just how. I can't tell you when we finally were engaged, but it wasn't too long after that.
And you were married when?
We were married in 1947. June of 1947, a year later. But we decided then that I should continue on the master's, continue on in the PhD program. It would be a good idea. And then we could, eventually we decided we could get married and survive. So I was getting some scholarship from Chevron. And she had a pretty good job working for Sage and Macy's. So.
Who else was doing a PhD in chemical engineering?
Well, okay, that's a good question. The first two chemical engineers who had finished their master's degree before the war came back at the same time I did, and they started on their PhD program while I was on the master's program. The first two were Bill Corcoran, who you probably heard of, and then Glenn Billman, who left after the United States. She went and worked for Chevron, still lives up in the Bay Area. And then in the second class, which was my class, there was two of us. One was Dave Mason, who was chairman of Timothy Lee Stanford for a long time, and myself, just the two of us. So Dave and I were number three and four PhD chemicals in Western Caltech. Then the classes got a little larger behind us, I think. Okay, put all the names in right front. Chronology. Neil Pings, I think, was in behind us. And Scott Lynn, who was at Berkeley, and a number of other people who have done quite well. Can't recall their names very, very well chronologically. But it was a very small knit group. Everybody knew everybody very well. And the master's program, I think, increased to where they had, I guess, eight people for the next couple of years. I was kind of where they were limited for a while, faculty-wise as well as space-wise. Because chemical engineering was, at Caltech, was in a room which was part of the boiler house. And we had to come through the entrance to the boiler room, through the two boilers for the whole campus steam plant. And then they went into the adjoining building, which contained the laboratory equipment for the PVT work, and then all the offices were upstairs.
Well, it was a sort of poor relation in the scheme of things, wasn't it?
Oh, it was never meant to be. I mean, it was never built to be what it was. It was a building that was originally built to be the steam plant, and there was room for expansion.
But I mean, I'm thinking intellectually, Linus Pauling kind of represented.
Oh, what? Well, yeah, Linus Pauling, of course, he was the division chairman by this time. And he was technically was over chemical engineering, but he didn't pay much attention to it. We saw very little of him by this time.
Yeah. But I'm thinking also that Caltech, I don't understand quite how this worked with the World War II. Caltech had such a basic science orientation to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, even if you're doing thermodynamics, it's kind of hard to compete with the basic science, as it were.
Well, what we were doing, I think, in our side wasn't competing with atomic energy, which to this day I don't know who was really aware of. I know a lot of people that were certainly involved in it. But the rocket propulsion was pretty much thermodynamics. And that was the main thing that the chemical engineering people were doing. It was the forerunners of JPL, and chemical engineering was involved with the aeronautics department as much as anything. Caltech had been, even when we used to go over there for their open house program back when I was in high school, they had a demonstration plant of a rocket fire, and it was pretty rudimentary, but that, even at that point, they were thinking about what could be done with rockets. And if you could get one out into space somehow, that was something that was in the mill. Of course, JPL was instrumental in getting our first satellite up after the Sputnik went up. And it was all the knowledge that we had put together up to that time. But they were basically developing rockets for munitions, scissors, as well as propulsion equipment. They fit together very well. I Sage had some ABC projects in there, and chemical engineering. Kitty was involved in them. But I never got too involved myself. I think it was more design of facilities rather than. Okay, they seem to mesh, but the chemical engineering, the chemists always thought they were, at that point in time, were something special. Something's here to just have an offshoot.
So what did doing your PhD mean? You weren't taking further coursework.
We were. I continued my work, my mathematics work, and then I had a minor in mechanical engineering, and I was involved. And I took a number of courses in mechanical engineering, and then we had courses in applied mechanics and structural engineering design, things like that. It's about a third of the time was spent in the classroom, I think, at that point. Of course, I spent a good deal of time doing my research. In those days, you had to build the equipment yourself that you used for your research program. Although we had a machine shop by then. I had a couple of people that I could help me do, but I had to put the piece of equipment together and order the parts. That was a major part of the effort. And I had three different. My pieces were composed of three different things. One was the thermodynamic properties of normal pentene, I think. It was one of the ones that hadn't been studied yet. And that's how I got involved with Chevron, because they had supported the cost of building this calorimeter that was the prime thing that had to be used there, and that had been sitting there all during the war, and I had to put that all back together again. But we had thermocouples, and we had galvanometers and stuff. Had the three reflections from the resistance thermometers to measure the temperatures. I mean, it was a lot of advances that make things a lot easier today. Today you just go out and buy a piece of equipment and do what you want to do. Some vendor. In those days, everything in the lab was made by the people in the laboratory, and the machine shop that we had there. Angel, we'd have to go into. We had a campus machine shop that was left over from the 200-inch Palomar telescope days. Mm-hmm. Well, that was available for the things that you couldn't do in your own. But every department had their own machine shop. Mm-hmm. Chemistry had theirs, chemicals had theirs. So it was an interesting one.
So the normal Pantene was one part of the thesis,
that
the one other part.
Then I had the thermodynamic properties of NO2.
Mm-hmm.
And publications on both of those. And then the third was a study of a turbine combustion flame. I had a predecessor that had worked on that, and I kind of took over. We had an annual circular pipe, which was about 6 inches in diameter, and maybe a 1-inch pipe that brought natural gas in, and combustion of the gas jet in there. The air that was coming in on the side and trying to determine the distribution of temperature and components downstream is a function of problem. It was a steady state, but we were trying to understand how it got to steady state. But we made the sad mistake of making the equipment horizontal rather than vertical, and so we had a lot of thermal gravitational effects that distorted everything. Well, I don't know, it was a terribly successful experiment. But there again, we had to build all the equipment for sampling the gas stream and measuring the temperatures in the plane. Anyway, that was the third one.
So that mix of, I mean, it's an interesting mix between the very practical stuff and the math and the thermodynamics.
That's true.
Did you like all parts of this mix?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I always liked to build things anyway. That part was easy for me.
But that must have made you a pretty attractive student, because, I mean, usually people tend to go one side or the other.
A lot of people had real problems building their equipment and making things. They didn't do too well. We had several people that didn't complete the PhD program, but ended up with a 2-year degree as a professional engineer. And we had some that switched back to chemistry. You know Paul Farrington?
Out
of UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of our group of 5th-year students. Mm-hmm. Original master's degree, and we went back to chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And another one was in that class with Hugh Baird. Hugh Baird became president of CF Braun Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And I now have him since folded.
Mm.
He's still around, but he was a passing.
So it sounds as if life was pretty good.
Well, yeah, I think all of the people in that class were quite successful. Well, anyway, I before I got my PhD, we were, Kenny and I got married in 47, and I didn't get my PhD until 49, so we had 2 years of survival there. And I had really thought by this time that I wanted to be involved in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I after I graduated, I was offered a position as an instructor there at Cal. It was first step below an assistant professor. And I did that for 4 years, I guess.
Had somebody else taken that route ahead of you?
No. No. I think we had in that fifth year master's program, we had a fellow that had gotten a chemical engineering degree back in 1940 or something like that, as an instructor in the lab. But Dave Mason, after he got his PhD, went to work for JPL. And I stayed on there at Caltech. Well, partly, I think, because Catherine, she wanted to continue working with Crusades. It would have been difficult if I'd gone someplace else. So. Anyway, I did teach for a couple of years. 3 years, 4 years. I didn't leave until 53. And at that time, I was kind of at the agreement between Sage and Lacey. I could go out and get some experience, and I would be a much better teacher if I knew what I was teaching my students to do, and I agreed with that. And that's when I went PepsiCo and went down to the Montebello Research Laboratory in 1953.
Mm-hmm. Those years from 49 to 53.
4 years.
4 years. What did your talk about your professional and career life?
My main goals there, although I was still doing, I had several research programs going on. I was teaching fluid mechanics and using thermodynamics, of course, in the fluid mechanics, but Sage still taught the thermodynamics course. And I was teaching the first year laboratory course for the master's people. That was one where they had to make their own equipment or learn how to make equipment. And I did further research,
which gave you a lot more exposure to that.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was a natural for me. And then I think some of the most interesting things that I did then was start using computers to develop equations of state to calculate the properties of components. And at that point, we had the Benedict and Rubin equation of state, and probably back at MIT, they developed the equation of state pretty much empirically using some data. And we developed, I think, the first program that would take a batch of thermodynamic data and calculate the constants for the Riemann-Mannich equation of state using some criteria of least square variation. And we had what was called, I think, a 640 IBM computer, which had a memory, I think, that was about the size of an IBM card. It all vacuum tubes operated, and we were able to write programs. We doubled the memory in the computer by printing out what was on a card leaving the machine on one that was coming in. So it was quite a long. It would take several hours to calculate the constants of the Riemann equation. But they did match. You could then, once you had the constants, you could calculate the thermodynamic properties of the equation. It had one exponential term, and that was rather difficult for the computers to do that pretty well. When did that publication happen? Mm-hmm. That was one of my.
Who, when you say we, this would be.
Well, it was a publication by Sage and myself and one of the graduate students, mm-hmm. Graduate students. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that was we adapted that computer to quite a few things, but boy, it was so. You had to wire all your program boards. You had to wire everything on back.
So this was a major piece of your kind of research.
Well, that was after I was graduate school, and I also did some work in developing some equipment to do some studies in diffusion, microcontrollers in the air. I think we continued to work on that diffusion plane too.
Mm-hmm. Were you going? When was the first time you left California?
Well, I had been vacationing outside of California for quite a number of times, but I never had worked outside of the state. In fact, I never had. Mm-hmm. Except on trips, but never business trips. But I had been over most of the western part of the country by the time. Well, when Kate and I were first married, we took camping vacations in Canada. Building from Montana, Vancouver, and to the border. So we'd seen a lot of this part of the country. When I was teaching there, I was on a program sponsored by the government, Project Vista, and it involved the whole campus. This was kind of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how I was involved in the ballistics program trying to calculate trajectories of missiles and things. As you can very well imagine what we could do today. But I did go back to the Maryland, Cougar Ground,
Were you, if this is the 50s, were you flying? How did you?
I was flying.
Which was what, 2 or 3 days maybe?
Yeah, you'd go one weekend and stay there a week and come back the next weekend. People get on a train Friday after work in Pasadena about 9 o'clock at night, and you could arrive and back to work Monday morning. And it was 3 nights and 2 days.
Your family, Katie's family, you've grown up in the West. How did you react to the East? What?
Well, this was, I guess that was, my first visit to the East was to give a paper at a Boston ACS meeting on this thing with Cuban equation. Ironically enough, there was a fellow from Caltech, Sherman was his name, who worked for Texaco when he was up in Poughkeepsie, up in Beacon. And he was the research technical department's computer expert. And he gave me a rough time on that paper. It was kind of ironic that I ended up going to Texas to work for him. But that was my first. No, that's not right. My father, when I graduated from high school, I forgot about that. My father, and sent my mother and me back to Detroit to pick up a new car, 1941. And we took the train back to Chicago and changed my mom to Detroit and drove back. Lincoln Zephyr.
What?
An experience. And so we did come back through South Dakota and North Dakota. We went across to Michigan, to Minneapolis on a ferry, and through the Black Hills, saw the restaurant memorial being carved out of the rocks, and the Yellowstone. That's great. And down from Reno. So that was really the first visit to the East Coast, and that was warm in Detroit. I remember the Edison, in the Edison Museum, I think that right there outside. Edison was the man that always fascinated me. Of the But yeah, that was. We went up and visited some of my mother's relatives on the Thousand Island Lakes. Islands up in the St. Lawrence River. We drove over there. It's too long across the border. We went down Ontario and up to Ghana and up. And that's where they communicated back and forth. They had a house out on an island, the only house on the island. No refrigeration, no electricity. Interesting. Well, I remember distinctly the nighttime. It was in June. Still perfectly light at 10 o'clock at night. Quite amazing. You see, you make a recall thing. Anyway, I did see that part of the country. Then I guess the next time I went was to the ACS meeting in Boston, representing Caltech at the ACS meeting.
Did you know, had you met, let's say, people on the MIT chemical engineering faculty before that?
Not very many. couple of them who visited Caltech, and after I was a graduate student at that island faculty, I remember Sherwood came out once. But you know, well, this was just a casual visit. He and Sage were of course quite involved. But I only MIT faculty I had met ever really met until I was in Texaco were those that came out to Pasadena and visit. Maybe at an ACS meeting I met some of them, but I don't.
Were you going, by then, were you going to, you know, to several meetings? Did you go to AICHE meetings?
I didn't really get very involved in AICHE I was a member of ACS when I was a student member, and then I dropped my student membership for a while, but I rejoined again in about the time I got my degree, because I wanted to get their publications, and all my stuff was being published in the Industrial Engineering and Chemistry, and now that I'm out of general ACS. So I paid my dues to ACS, but I got my 15-year membership. I'm not feeling well. I'm just 4 or 5 years ago now. But I didn't join the AICHE until I was with Texaco. I guess in the mid-50s. I still am not 50 year member of AICHE. Although after then I was quite active in the ICHE. I was on the board of the local section. For a number of years.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about that sort of professional world. Were you going to an ACS local section meetings or what?
Well, you know, I didn't go to much of the local ACS meetings after I left Caltech. I was very active in the local AICHE meetings during the time I was at Montebello. That encouraged my people to belong. And one of my people who worked there was chairman of the music program. But Alan Beck was also. But that didn't seem, we had, I didn't rely on the AICHE as my source of engineering. It just wasn't that much. I mean, I gave several papers and talks to the ICHE and FRS of Texaco in several presentations. I was involved in the local section. I knew the people, and particularly the people in the construction business who were the primary people in the in that section, like people at Bond, people at Parsons, people at Moore, moving on.
But you're still back in Caltech now. You've got enough people to talk to essentially in the Caltech world too.
Well, I do, and I've always maintained contacts with a lot of my Caltech friends, and which I kept up with Sage and Mason after I got Caltech. Bruce Sage was a consultant for PepsiCo. Mm-hmm. That's kind of partly why he knew about the Mount Dollar Research Laboratory and knew they needed somebody. So that's why I went there. And he was a consultant long after, even after I was running the laboratory, he was a consultant for us. He had a lot of things in common. But I kind of lost track of Caltech for a number of years, and then got back with him in the 60s.
Still back in that early 50s, as an instructor, you didn't have graduate students of your own.
Oh yeah, they were all graduates. Not of my own. No. I was not their primary advisor. But this was saved, but I was inside on them.
You did the work.
I did the work, yeah, right. And or they see you on. But we didn't, we only had half a dozen at the most graduates in this year.
Yeah.
Outside of the master's program.
Yeah. And so the idea of it was really in the context of an academic career that the idea of going into industry was.
Yeah, that was my original concept. I wanted to get some direct hand, first-hand information and learn about how things worked in industry. I had a pretty good idea of what went on academically. That was about the time we started talking on the faculty meetings about admitting women to Caltech. When I was there, it wouldn't happen for another 10 years.
Because it was that's the other thing just to mention. This was an all male.
It was a. No undergraduate. I had a few women graduate students.
But not in chemical engineering?
Not in chemical engineering. No.
So how did the thinking develop? Talk about moving from Caltech, how that worked.
Well,
why Texaco and so on?
In my mind, I was there temporarily, but nobody else knew that, except the fellow that ran the lab, who was Eastman. I don't know if you've ever heard of him or not, but he was quite a remarkable engineer himself, and very inventive. And he started out. He graduated from Berkeley and went to work for Texaco down in Signal Hill, down in the oil fields. Back in the 20s, he was graduated in 20s. And he was worked up through the research group in Texaco and was spent a number of years developing a fluid catalytic cracking. And he was Texaco's main contribution to the joint committee that was working on fluid catalytic cracking about the time the war broke out. And the fluid bed there were several different versions of catalytic cracking, but the fluid bed was what Texaco was involved in, what Eastman was trying to. And he was really instrumental in getting that pixel fluid involved in that. We got a number of catalytic crackers for some of the refinery we had, but that was pretty well a fait accompli by the time the war was really underway. And he was then appointed to be Texaco's representative on the government project to develop synthetic rubber. And he was instrumental in designing that first butadiene separation plant down in Fort Manchester, Texas. And after the war, he had the idea that along with a man named Dobie Keith, who was at Hydrocarbon Research Institute. Well, I think Dobie Keith actually came to Texaco with a thought that we could convert natural gas into synthesis gas in this, and use the German Fischer-Tropsch technology to make synthetic crude out of natural gas. And he went to Texaco and convinced Texaco this was a good idea. And Texaco and HRI decided to build a plant down in Brownsville, a demonstration plant, which would have been, of course, in several things. We used fluidized bed kind of Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, and burn natural gas with oxygen to make syngas. And when Chips got down, it turned out it was a good idea, but nobody really knew how to do it. And Dobie Keith could tell you how to do it, but Dobie Keith told you wasn't what was going to work. And his concept was to have a bed full of ceramic rings and run the gas and oxygen over the bed and have them all come out converted to carbon, and hydrogen. Somebody seemed to forget was when you really applied thermodynamics to this thing, you found that carbon was a pretty stable component in such a system. So you came up with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. And it wasn't until Eastman got the idea of getting rid of all this packing and putting these things together and oxygen, like the diffusion flame that we had up there at Caltech, which was natural gas and air we were burning, but he wanted to burn natural gas and oxygen, which thermodynamically, if you did this correctly, you could run it around 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit and come out. Without making carbon, as long as you can get through that phase where carbon is a stable component, which happens when you get down around 2,000 degrees. So you had to have get this flame hot, get everything hot, and then somehow quench this gas through this over temperature. And so they decided that they needed the laboratory to demonstrate what Texaco thought they could do for this program. And Eastman was to run this laboratory. And he had Cartmel put the laboratory, I guess, wherever he wanted to put it, but he had a good reason for it. And he went back to California, and he didn't come to Texas. He said, the natural gas in Texas has sulfur in it, and we don't want to go through the expense of having to take the sulfur out of the gas before we burn it. There's a field out in Montebello that had sulfur-free gas, and there was a gas plant there at that time. They were compressing gas and putting it in the distribution system. Anyway, so they tried to talk him into building it in a refinery down in Wilmington, and he said, no, the gas was better at Montebello. So he got from the refining department a little part of the land that they owned there, they were having the natural gasoline plant. They were producing the food and separating the natural gas. And the liquids and they had putting it right into the distribution system. And they had probably 10, 12 compressors that were running around the top, compressing the gas. And we just bred a little gas out of it for our use.
When was
this? This was beginning in about 1947.
Right. Okay.
And they were having problems getting a burner that would not make carbon. And that's when they came to Caltech and got Crusade to consult for them. And he had some pretty good ideas, and he came up with the design of the burner, which is still there, patented, call that patent to run out. But patents don't tell you how to make the burner exactly. And that is what's used today. Everybody wanted to develop burner, had a bunch of little holes in it like they have in the burner from the stove, but this is just a singular annular diffusion plane. And we got it, really got it, you know, got it working. First, we had to develop factories that would hold up under these temperatures. It wasn't too bad with natural gas. But the winter oil was a lot of slides we had to deal with. But this plant was enlarged and scaled up and put down in Brownsville. And when I went to work in 1953, the plant was just starting up in Brownsville. And they had the biggest oxygen plant in the world down there, and that building, even though it wasn't very big by today's standards.
But they
were still having problems.
Was that oxygen plant, that was some company like Lindy or somebody had done them a plant?
And of course, nobody had successfully compressed pure oxygen in a compressor without blowing things up. So this plant pumped the liquid up to pressure and then vaporized the liquid. That's thermodynamically, this wasn't very efficient. Well, they didn't cast turbines for the gas turbo compressors. Very well designed.
So once the discussions on the Caltech campus, the idea had come up that you would go into industry, it was pretty, you didn't go and interview at 20 places or something.
I was offered a job at DuPont back in Wilmington. I was offered a job up at Chevron, and I was offered a job.
So you did go out to different places.
I did talk to the two people, but I mean my idea, who we had just started our family, we had one child on the way, and Mike was already 2 years old, and so moving to Wilmington for 2 or 3 years or 4 years, it didn't look very attractive, and I could just drive to Montebello. And that was, I think, a fortunate. Well, I don't know what happened if I had done the other, but it turned out very, and I got really going with Texaco and Montebello.
What was the, Montebello, what were you hired as, and what did Montebello consist of, and who was there? What
at this point
in 1953?
It was a small group. They had I was the fourth chemical engineer in addition to Mr. Eastman, Lawrence Eastman. And we have 200 in attendance. And we had a laboratory manager by Norman Beck. And we had enough people to run pilots around the clock 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Plus we had some maintenance crew that weren't working at 8. I think the total number of employees was about 40 people.
Mm-hmm. When you say 2 hours of chemists, fourth chemical engineer, are these PhD level people?
No. There are no PhDs there except the year before I was hired, they had hired a PhD from MIT named Charles Marion. And I was the second PhD. We had PhDs back in Beacon and some down in Port Arthur, but none at Onondaga. And Charles Marion was a combustion, he majored in combustion with Pavel back at MIT. And he was quite an addition. He was working specifically on this burner problem.
Mm-hmm. So you were pretty highly qualified. I mean, pretty...
What
salvation were you to bring?
When they brought me... But my first assignment had dribbled down from the vice president of the R&D department, who had been on the government committee to review what the United States should do to prepare for the coming oil shortage. We're going to run out of oil. And it was recognized that we didn't have enough indigenous oil to go on much longer. And the recommendation that came from this committee was we've got to go to oil shale. Mm-hmm. That was my assignment. Figure out how to get oil out of oil shale.
Oh, small task. A small task to start with.
And that was my first assignment. I wasn't even involved in this, mm-hmm. this combustion project. Mm-hmm.
You said the vice president for R&D. Where was he?
He was in Beijing. He was in New York.
And there was a big R&D production.
We had our main research laboratories were in Beacon, New York, and he shuttled between Chrysler Building and again office down there as well as an office up in Beacon.
And how many chemists and chemical engineers were in Beacon?
Oh, they had probably mostly chemists, but and mechanical engineers. They probably had 500 people. Mexico's main R&D lab.
And a man and a boy in Monticello.
Yeah, well, that's right. And then this is where this Sherman was that I told you about, that knew all about the computers. He was up at Beacon. They had all the engine testing, they did all the development of lubricants and the additive development. And then when they needed to pull something out, they would go down to Port Arthur and the refinery, and they would sail it up and pilot plant, and eventually it might go in the commercial production.
I don't know enough about Texaco history. Why were they in New York if the very name says Texas?
That is part of it. I think the management of the company felt back in the early 20s that if you were going to be a worldwide company, and have a presence in New York. And they moved in, I think, as one of the initial primary tenants of the Chrysler Building when it was completed in the late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, I don't know, they, I mean, I think they, a lot of people were hurt. I mean, a lot of influential people in Texas were very unhappy to see Texaco move to New York, but they did that. And then they wanted, they decided they needed a first-class research department, and then were separate from, and isolated from the administrative operations of the Beacon, the bottom old, weaving plant or some kind of a mill up there that ran off the water wheel from the river that comes down. Not from the Hudson River, but it goes through the back of the plant. And they started there and they built up from that. And all of it, they moved all the automobile testing and everything was up there, developing factory fill lubricants, and it was a big thing in the railroad lubricants were huge in those days. And they were respected, the leader in the company was developing greases. It's all done up there, and this was just kind of a university campus. First time I went there, it was shortly after I started to work for Texaco. I was given the job of.
So they were into sort of long range.
Research. Oh yeah, this was a long range research laboratory. And, they were doing stuff up there on Fisher Trucks, synthesis.